Yesterday evening, I mentioned that it was Judgment Day yesterday. And was that really just 24 hours ago, or was it actually 3 days? How many would say 3 days? Okay. Of lived experience, yeah. There's apparently a bumper sticker that we were thinking of giving to everyone who completes the retreat. And the bumper sticker says, "Non-judgment day is near." I want to give a kind of overview of the work of transforming the judgmental mind, talking about really the nature of the judgmental mind, what it looks like, why it's important to work with and transform the judgmental mind, and in brief, how we do it. So a kind of an overview both of the nature of the judgmental mind and how the transformation occurs. And I was reflecting that in some ways we can talk about this practice that we do in a very simple way, which is always helpful. That in one way of seeing what we're doing here is that we are developing the capacity to be responsive rather than reactive, to be able to be increasingly in the present moment and not be driven so much by our habits, by our tendencies, by our conditioning. And this opens up what we might call the space of freedom. Responsiveness is a very ordinary way of talking about freedom, meaning that we're not reactive. And there are different dimensions to this quality of being responsive. There's the dimension of awareness. Can I be aware of what's happening without that reactivity? And reactivity is a term that we use in a meditative context to refer to two main tendencies. One is to compulsively, semi-consciously or unconsciously push away what's happening in experience. And the other type of reactivity is the counterpart. It's to grab hold of experience. Again, compulsively, semi-consciously, unconsciously. And the third support for the reactivity is often grouped with the first form, which is sometimes called aversion, the pushing away, and the second form, which is sometimes called grasping or greed, the grabbing hold. And that third form, or that third support, is typically called delusion. And as long as we are held by the aversion, by the grasping hold, and by the delusion, we can't really be responsive. We can't really be free. And of course, what happens in that space of being driven by the aversion, the grasping, and the delusion is that those are really the roots of suffering, whether individual suffering or interpersonal suffering, suffering at the level of community, more collective suffering, the suffering of violence and conflict and wars. And our practice is really to continually to train to be responsive. And the responsiveness has that quality of awareness, to be able to be present, which we train in the mindfulness. It also has the quality of an open heart. It has the quality of kindness. and warmth that we're also training in. And again, our training is to increasingly be able to bring qualities of awareness and qualities of kindness into all situations. And of course, we can do that more easily in some situations than others. And then I would say maybe the third quality of this responsiveness is understanding. We could call that wisdom. So we really train in a simple way to talk about the essence of our practice as we train in awareness, in kindness and the open heart, and in wisdom. And we also, as a large part of our training, we see what gets in the way of the awareness being manifest, the kindness being manifest, and the wisdom being manifest. And as I mentioned last night, in a way, we could see the entirety of our training as, on the one hand, cultivating these beautiful qualities, and on the other hand, seeing what stands in the way. And one of the main forms of habitual energy that stands in the way is what we're calling the judgmental mind. It's quite a force, and I think very much so in contemporary culture, particularly in terms of self-judgment. We don't seem to find self-judgment in the same way in other cultures before sort of modern Western culture. You find plenty of other issues and problems, and you find judgment of others. Some of you may remember that Jesus has these lines about judging others. Judge not, lest ye be judged. Probably some of you studied that a long time ago. Judge not, lest ye be judged. Why do you point to the plank in your brother's eye or the splinter in your brother's eye when all the time there's a plank in your own? Hypocrite, take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will be able to take the splinter out of your brother's eye. I can't give you the exact verse and chapter and so forth, but some of you may remember that. So you find judgment there, but you don't find this particularly self-judgment in the same way. In fact, many of the Asian teachers who first brought Buddhist practice to the West were very confused by the Western judgmental mind, particularly self-judgment. And I remember being at the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts in the late 1970s, I think 1979, on one of the first trips of the Dalai Lama to the U.S. And it was wonderful, you know. I didn't even have to go anywhere. I was just doing a retreat, and he happened to come to my retreat. I thought that was pretty cool. And there was a time for questions, and someone asked a question. My memory is that they were on cards. There were some cards read. And someone asked the question, I don't think that I deserve love. Please comment. And the Dalai Lama was befuddled, which is not usually what happens to Dalai Lamas. You know, he speaks pretty good English, as probably many of you know. And he went back and forth to the translator like for 4 or 5 minutes, like, what does that mean? All in Tibetan. You know, he was going back and forth. And finally, he just blurted out, you're wrong. You deserve love. Next question. Very un-Dalai Lama-like. And he later said that he was very confused by this conditioning. And he heard many accounts of the conditioning from Western teachers. And he had that sort of first-hand encounter. And he said he studied that tendency in the Western mind for 2 years with the aid of psychologists to better understand what was going on. So it's this deep tendency that is one of the main forces that makes that quality of responsiveness difficult, I should say. Makes it difficult. It's a very habitual force. It can take us over. We can be in a kind of a cloud or a trance with the judgmental mind. And in a way, it comes very naturally out of human tendencies, right? It's very interesting. It comes very naturally out of tendencies. I want this, you know, I'm not getting it, or I don't want this, I'm getting it, or I need this, and you seem to be standing in the way of it. You know, it can be understood very much as sort of a very ordinary expression of maybe not having certain needs met. We get judgmental towards ourselves. I don't meet these needs for myself. I'm judgmental of myself. I don't meet needs of others. And we might ask, you know, what's really wrong with it? You know, isn't it just about trying to get things okay? And so we have to look carefully, really, to see why the judgmental mind is a problem. Because it's that quality of reactivity. And the reactivity will lead us to want something or not want something and just be on automatic without necessarily having awareness, without having kindness, without having wisdom. And we're just on automatic, and we can create a lot of harm, and we can be involved with different kinds of conflicts. From the 8th century, this is Shantideva, actually the Dalai Lama's favorite author. I think he keeps by his bedside a copy of Shantideva's book called A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life. And some of you may have heard him teach on that text. This is Shantideva. A crazy, untamed elephant in this world cannot inflict such harm as the sufferings of the deepest hell caused by the rampaging elephant of the mind. So judgments can manifest that rampaging elephant at times. And I thought I'd just throw this in. This is from Mark Twain. And he uses judgment in a little bit different sense than I'm using it, but I think this is good to have out there. Good judgment comes from experience. So he's using judgment in that more neutral sense, meaning discernment. Good judgment comes from experience. Experience comes from bad judgment. So let me review a little bit the nature of judgments, give some examples, invite you to come up with your examples and even share some of them here. So again, I'm using the judgmental mind. We're using the term judgmental mind to indicate this combination of typically some kind of noticing or observation or evaluation linked with reactivity. And we're distinguishing the judgmental mind in that sense from more neutral judgments. Again, in English, we would use the word judgment more neutrally. I think it's used in quite a few other European languages in very similar ways. Judgments we might call neutral. I mentioned some of these earlier today. We could talk about artistic judgments or aesthetic judgments or the judgments of the scientist that this was a solution to the problem. We sometimes would use the word judgment in that sense. We could talk about legal judgments and so forth. And those would typically be understood more neutral. And in particularly in those first examples, they'd be something that we could call a kind of discernment or a kind of seeing of something that is the case without reactivity, right? In those kind of examples. And the judgmental mind brings in this aspect of reactivity. It's some kind of typically pushing away or a form of aversion, although I think there also are forms of judgment, as I mentioned, that can be positive, so-called grasping, grasping onto them. And so let's think of some examples of judgment in that sense, in that sense of a combination of noticing something, but then having typically a negative pushing away, a reactivity, you know. So here are a few examples. This is from a cartoon called Rhymes with Orange. And these are some examples of judgments. And you can listen if you can see if you can get a sense of what the noticing is along with the reactivity. Choose someone and compare yourself unfavorably to that person. These are 6 ways of becoming totally miserable, is the title of the cartoon. Examine your face closely in the mirror. Notice all flaws. Okay. If any of this is overly triggering, just breathe and do metta for self, if you can. Okay. Relive embarrassing, awful moments that occurred years ago. Okay. Some nods of recognition. Okay. Make a mental note of all the people you regularly disappoint. Disregard all compliments, especially from people who supposedly love you. And it shows a woman talking to another woman who says, "You look great," and she says, "Don't patronize me." Resign yourself to believing that from now on, this is how you will always feel. And so judgments are dramatic and powerful and can be connected with a lot of suffering. There's also very ordinary. This is a cartoon of a man before an elevator, and the caption of the cartoon is "the idiot on my shoulder," and the person on the shoulder is saying, "Try pushing the button a few more times, that might make the elevator move faster." We know that one, "Oh my gosh, I chose the wrong line, the wrong checkout line at the supermarket, or the wrong line, I don't know, on the toll bridge," or whatever, you know. And so we can judge ourselves, we can have large and small judgments. And so it's helpful just to get a sense of judgments. What kind of judgments may have arisen just today? You know, maybe from meditating. Yeah. Anyone want to volunteer one? Please. Yeah. So if you could say it in one sentence, what would the judgment be?
That I'm not very good at seated meditation.
I'm not very good at seated meditation. You know, or it might be, I'm sleepy, I'm wasting my time. Right? And remember, we're looking for that kind of reactivity that makes it a judgment. As I think I mentioned last night, it's actually not the actual words or the content which make there be a judgment. We can have the same words. I gave the example of me as a teacher. I could say something like, "I think you need to develop a little, let's work a little bit more and develop a little more in this area." I could say that with compassion and interest. I could also say that with a different tone, the exact same words. That would be cutting and would show the person that actually there's not that interest or compassion, right? So it's actually interesting. The judgment is marked by reactivity, and as human beings, we convey that reactivity partly by language, but also by tone, by gesture, by body language, by all sorts of ways that we could actually say the exact same words. Any other judgments might have appeared today? Yeah, maybe in one sentence. See if you could say it. Yeah, if I'm having all these thoughts, my practice isn't so skillful, and I really should have meditated more in the last 6 months. Now I'm paying for it. You deserve it, you know, or something like that, or I'm so sleepy. Maybe I should just do walking meditation all the time, you know. Any others? Yeah.
Your attention is so bad. That
Yeah, your attention is so bad, something must be wrong, you know. And And all of these are more negative, and though they're even though we were saying them with some degree of humor, there's actually some harshness there, isn't there? They might be based, again, it's helpful to see, they all are probably based to some degree on some kind of observation, right? It might be, I'm not attending so well. We could actually have the observation without going to the judgmental mind. Right? In all of these examples, we could say, I'm not attending so well, or my posture is not so straight. You know, it could lead to other things, but we go to the judgmental mind in that way. And that's crucial. As I mentioned, the nature of the judgmental mind to be a mix of some kind of observation or some kind of noticing or discernment with reactivity points to the way it can be transformed, I think. Because, again, we can work through in different ways the reactivity and then be able to use whatever insight there was for the purposes of skillful action, compassionate action. Ideally, I could, as a teacher, if I find myself being judgmental, I could try to learn from that and say, what can I learn from this? And can I take that insight? Or we could take ourselves as a meditator and actually learn from being judgmental. A lot of the work that I did in a very focused way on the judgmental mind came at a time when I had been working very hard in the world, and I entered a two-month retreat. It was actually the same retreat where I first met Heather. We were doing a two-month retreat together, and maybe we'll tell some other stories from that retreat. We'll see. But on that retreat, I was, at the beginning of the retreat, I was judging myself very harshly for not having gone to more retreats in the last period of time. In other words, I'm not spiritually adequate. And I was comparing myself very harshly to other people who I thought had done it right. Of course, I didn't actually really know that well what they had done, and actually when I later came to know what they had done, the comparison was off. But of course, that doesn't matter so much for the judging mind, does it? All we need is some hypothetical comparison, and there I was. So it was very harsh. It was really quite mean-spirited to myself. And it actually opened up a period of practicing where I began to work with the judgments in a more focused way. I'd actually worked with them in other ways for some time. But that would give an example that if we actually look, well, what is the discernment there that's kind of beneath the surface? It's not so much in the comparison of myself with another person, but we could actually, if we go into that and say, what's the intelligence of that judgment? Well, maybe it's something like practice is really important to me, right? We could kind of see that beneath the surface, right? But I wouldn't have got that for a while, right? So you can see, so this is important, that the judgmental mind is actually not the enemy. It can and often does carry some intelligence or some insight or something of value. And it's not something that we just need to get rid of. Actually, we need to transform judgments rather than get rid of them. If we get rid of the judgmental mind, we get rid of the insights. Okay, so that's an important point here. And we'll be in different ways looking to unpack the meaning of that somewhat more. So what are some other examples of the judgmental mind? I mean, they again can be large and small. They can be very, very ordinary. We can be at a light and someone can be on a cell phone. And I can get very judgmental. Oh, they shouldn't be on the cell phone. People are getting so caught up in this electronic stuff. And we can get into judgments of the person or of the larger culture or whatever. And we can be very reactive with that way. So they can be small. They can be small in that sense, and they can be large. There can be self judgments that actually can take us into depression or despair, and can be very, very harsh. Judgments of other people can lead to polarization and even estrangement or the breakdown of relationships. Strong judgments in the context of nations can lead to conflicts and wars. Yeah. And so it really is this very, very crucial area. And it's something that I have found is there, even in people who've done a lot of psychological work or a lot of spiritual work. You know, I've taught several times, as has Heather, our two-month retreat, where we get some of the most dedicated practitioners who are willing to practice for 1 month or 2 months at a time. And I think we find, in a large number of them, that there's work to do with judgments. In a way, that judgmental mind, it's a kind of barrier, in my perception, that makes it harder to go to the depths. And so it's very important work to do on quite a number of different levels. There's also a very strong cultural dimension, social dimension to judgments, which I think is probably important for all of us. The culture can be very, very judgmental in all sorts of ways. And one of the forms that this manifests in is in the way that we have a lot of sort of general cultures that come from the mainstream. You know, that we tend to internalize. And the judgments are often organized, I think I mentioned this last night, they're often organized in terms of the different kinds of hierarchies that we have in our society. So there can be judgments related to gender or sexual orientation or ethnicity or race or age or religion or what else? What else am I not mentioning?
Socioeconomic.
What? Yeah, socioeconomic status, educational level, and so forth, right? And there are certain kind of mainstream judgments that people generally in the bottom part of the hierarchy get coming at them, you know, and pretty thick, you know, pretty thick at times. And, you know, we all, especially in relation to age, will encounter this some. And some people, it's a major force that one has to grapple with in one's life. You know, one example of this that's, for me, is kind of tragic, came from studies that were done in the 1940s and early 1950s of African-American young women, young girls, actually not women, but girls in Harlem. And there were studies done by Mamie and Kenneth Clark, who I think were connected with Brooklyn College. That's where my mom went to school, right? I don't know if you knew them. But, and I should say that my mom always says that her favorite topic is always judgments, right? Right. We'll come back to that maybe. And so, so they did this study, and it was a study that's probably well known. Some of you probably know the study. It's called the doll study. Anyone studied this in school? Probably quite a number of you. And this is a study where they showed these young girls, 6 to 9, a black doll and a white doll. And they asked, what is the good doll and what is the bad doll? And the girls said that the black doll is bad and the white doll is good. And then they asked them, which doll is like you? And something like half the girls refused to answer. It was like we would say, it was cognitive dissonance, we would say. Right? They didn't want to go there. And then half of them did answer. You know, and so, and when people have done some studies recently in some populations, it's not actually that different. You know, and so what does that show? they have internalized that message in a very deep way at a young age, and how does that get reversed, right? It's very thick, right? It's heartbreaking, isn't it, if you really stay with that. And we can see that on multiple levels with these forums. And so this is another aspect of the judgmental mind. We all internalize some of them. We internalize in a negative way where we're on the lower part of the hierarchy. And we're often, and sometimes we're unconscious of that, but sometimes we're aware of that. You know, I've had African-American friends, particularly women, who've been in groups where they deal with what they call internalized depression. And maybe some of you have done something like that, similar to what might be done with women's groups, right? Where one works with the internalized conditioning. And so there it's sometimes clear when it's more oppressive. When we're at the upper part of the hierarchy, we internalize the message, but guess what? We don't want to look at it too much, and we're actually fairly oblivious often. We can call the first kind internalized oppression, the second kind internalized privilege, right? And we're generally, we don't look at it very much. Do you know that? Do you know that one? And so this is important to look at. This is a, this gives an example of this. This is from Margaret Cho. People know Margaret Cho. Kind of a activist comedian. Is that accurate? Okay. So this is her talking about this whole territory. If you were a woman, if you were a person of color, if you were gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, if you were a person of size, if you were a person of intelligence, if you were a person of integrity, then you are considered a minority in this world. And it's going to be really hard to find messages of self-love and support anywhere, especially women's and gay men's culture. It's all about how you have to look a certain way or else you're worthless. You know, when you look in the mirror and you think, I'm so fat, I'm so old, I'm so ugly, don't you know that's not your authentic self? But that is billions upon billions of dollars of advertising, magazines, movies, billboards, all geared to make you feel shitty about yourself so that you'll take your hard-earned cash and spend it on the mall on some turnaround cream that doesn't turn around shit. Not my usual language in Dharma talks, but anyway. When you don't have self-esteem, you will hesitate before you do anything in your life. You will hesitate to go for the job you really want to go for. You will hesitate to ask for a raise. You will hesitate to call yourself an American. You will hesitate to report a rape. You will hesitate to defend yourself when you are discriminated against because of your race, your sexuality, your size, your gender. You will hesitate to vote. You will hesitate to dream. For us to have self-esteem is truly an act of revolution, and our revolution is long overdue. So there's that dimension, very, very strong dimension of judgments that is part of the map if we want to work with the judgmental mind. So there are these different sources of judgment. Some of them may come from our family. Some of them may come more directly from the society. Some of them may come from particular experiences we've had in life, right? And so you can sense that the working with the judgmental mind is a lot. And if we actually would work with it, it's actually not just personally significant, but it could be very significant on a larger level in terms of society. It's also, as I mentioned, a really significant part of spiritual practice that we can really have the judgmental mind often be strong in relation to our spirituality, as with my example. You know, as with some of the examples just of sitting and having the usual first day challenges of being distracted. How many people felt a little distracted at some point? How many felt sleepy? Okay, you might want to keep your hand up. Okay, how many felt like there was some wanting going on? I want this. How many felt some aversion? How many felt some doubt? These were the so-called five hindrances or difficult energies. What was your term?
Wake-up calls
that we work with. And these are very, very typical the first day. In fact, whether one's done 30 retreats or one's done zero retreats, it's sort of the territory for everyone. So remember that if the judgmental mind starts to arise in relationship to how one's doing. So we have spiritual images of ourselves, very strong theme in spirituality, and it's something that we find in many texts. As I mentioned, in the teachings of Jesus, you have this very, very, very simple message to look at your judgmental mind, look at where particularly you're judging others, and look into that. And there's also a very nice line. Let me find this. This is from the Jewish tradition. Great are the righteous, for they transform judgment into mercy. Great are the righteous, for they transform judgment into mercy. And very strong theme also in a lot of psychology. There's a line from Carl Jung, which relates the work of transforming the judgmental mind to self-knowledge. He says, that which we don't know in ourselves, some part of ourselves, some aspect of ourselves which we don't know, we tend to project outwards onto others, where we encounter it as demonic. And, of course, we'd be judging of it. So he links the whole aspect of judgment to a lack of self-knowledge, to a lack of really knowing ourselves in a deep way. So how do we work with the judgmental mind? How do we transform it? Last night I gave some beginning indication of the kind of the strategy that we'll have at this retreat, where we'll be primarily working with judgments as inner work. There's also a very important place that we'll touch near the end of the retreat of working with the judgmental mind when it comes up in the middle of interaction in interpersonal relationships. We can give a lot of attention to communication, to speech, to working with conflict and all sorts of. So we could have a 3-month curriculum here. We could have a 3-month retreat on judgments, but we'll start with 6 days. Okay. So the starting point, and this was really my own starting point in practice, was just to start being mindful of judgments. So part of the initial practice is to start tracking the judgmental mind, start noticing it, use our mindfulness, strengthen our mindfulness, and just start to notice it when it occurs, especially here at the retreat. We'll also do some guided meditations where we invite us to bring up to consciousness some of our more habitual judgments. But we also want to start to have that lens on for noticing judgments that retreats. It's fascinating to watch the judgmental mind at retreat. I actually, as I mentioned, had some really major learning watching the judgmental mind on a 2-month retreat and watching all the small little things. I don't like, one of the things I really remember is when they were serving tacos one day for lunch and it was raining in California. It used to rain in the winter. And this was February, and it was raining, and I was outside. I don't know if you remember this meal, but
I do.
we were all online outside waiting, and I was finding myself being very judgmental, because at this point, when there's a long line on the food line, I know that it's because there's an excess of condiments. This is the deep insight that comes from working with my own judgmental mind. But, so I think at that point I knew there were condiments. I wasn't sure what was being served. It turned out to be tacos. There were a lot of condiments. And I was sitting there outside in the rain saying, why can't they have these arranged so we can move through more quickly? Don't they know we're out in the rain? And so forth. So, this is a These are the kind of judgments you can notice, or, you know, I don't know, the person next to you comes in late, or I won't mention all the possible things that can form judgments because I don't want to give you too many ideas. But all these things happen, and we can track those. We can start noticing the judgments. Just start tracking them here and just give them a little bit of a label. As I mentioned, one can also, when the judgments are there for a little longer time, see what they're like in the body. See what the storyline is. We can explore them in more depth in that way. If we were working in a sustained way, we would also start to be mindful of the patterns of the judgment. What tends to trigger the judgment? When I was doing some important work with judgmental mind, I was going to meetings with the person who was the head of the organization. We had these meetings every 2 weeks, and I had the experience of often bringing up points and having this leader often change the subject not long after I'd brought up points that were important to me. That was a very neutral way of saying actually what happened, wasn't it? So that gets into our how do you skillfully describe situations without being judgmental. How would I have said that judgmentally? You know, with a certain tone, maybe saying, he's a really bad listener, you know, or something like that.
Jerk, he never listens to me.
That jerk, he never listens to me. What's he doing? He's so authoritarian, or whatever it might be, right? And I would, in looking at this experience, I would just notice myself having the experience of very quickly moving to being judgmental. You know, and it would be like something would happen, I'd notice myself being judgmental. And I would, I studied that, and I came to see that it was something like something would happen I didn't like, and I would just be triggered and go right into what I called, what came later to call emotionally distanced stance of moral superiority. This is a very common strategy, right? That we, many of, anyone relate to that? Okay, very good. So I worked with that and started to be able to study it and actually be in the process and look at that tendency, try to bring the mindfulness. So these patterns would recur no matter what I said or did, they would recur. And I would be in that situation. I would try to look carefully at what was happening. And I found myself able to, over time, start to slow things down. I started to find, oh, there's that moment where I could feel some reaction there. I started to go to these meetings and do walking meditation the way the meetings, and try to actually really bring mindfulness to the situation. And I came to see that there was a moment when I slowed things down, I could actually feel that doesn't feel good to be not listened to, or whatever way I would say it. And I could, when I could actually be in touch with that unpleasant aspect of it, I could notice my mind tending to go to judgments, but it wouldn't necessarily go if I could actually tune into the pain. And this actually became an approach that I later used in a meditative way. That example with the tacos, I use practices, which we'll use, I think, starting tomorrow. I think tomorrow, where we actually have a judgment and bring the attention into the body as a way of seeing what's beneath it. And I could actually feel, with the tacos example, oh, I feel impatience. Not surprising. And I would actually tune into the impatience, which we could say was the kind of the pain underneath the judgment. When I tuned into that, the judgment tended to dry up. You know, over time at this retreat, I used that practice. Every time there was a judgment, I tried to tune into the body and see what was there. And it took some time to really, for this technique to work. But over time, I came to see that virtually every judgment I looked at, there was some pain beneath it that I was typically not aware of. That was relatively unconscious. You could see in that example with the tacos, it was, I'm impatient, right? In the example with the boss, it was, it's painful not to be listened to or not to be heard, whatever language we use. And I could actually feel that. And when I felt it, it opened up some place of freedom. So I could say to the boss, you know, the point I just made is an important one for me. I'd like us to come back to it. Something non-reactive, non-judgmental that I was able to come to when I was actually not reactive because I was actually touching the pain. And we'll look at this quite a bit more, but what I came to see was that the judgmental mind is driven by some kind of unacknowledged or unprocessed pain, which also suggests a way of transforming it, right? If we can actually touch that pain and work with it with presence in a healing way, there becomes it's part of how we would transform it. Now the second main way of transforming the judgment, again talked about briefly last night, is that if that's true, that the judgments are driven to a certain extent by pain, that means that going into the judgments to a certain extent means to go into difficult territory, can be unpleasant, right? Can be painful. And so we need quite a lot of resources to do that, especially with the difficult ones. But even with the smaller ones, we need resources. And this is where the strategy that's really more of an indirect approach to transforming judgments, where we use the heart practices, especially here on this retreat, where we work with loving kindness, and we'll tomorrow look at compassion, the next day we'll work with forgiveness, which are amazing practices which tend to work in quite a few different ways that help us to transform the judgments. They give us more balance in our being. Basically, they let us hang out with beautiful states more and more. They let us hang out with the loving kindness or the compassion, with the mindfulness and so forth. And in itself, or joy, and in itself, that's very important as a way of kind of balancing our being. And generally, this is not always understood in practice. We actually have taken on, or we're taking on a lot when we engage in practice. We're taking on looking at our stuff and working through it, right? That's a lot. And so we really need to be with a lot of joy and beauty and wonder, and really have that in a way balanced. This is a poem from Mary Oliver that really expresses this quality of the need for her. It comes through beauty and being connected with the trees and the ocean and so forth. But listen to her voice, because I think you can hear in this poem some judgment. She says, "When I am among the trees, especially the willows and the honey locust, equally the beech, the oaks, and the pines, they give off such hints of gladness. I would almost say that they save me, and daily. I am so distant from the hope of myself." That's a very strong statement, right? I am so distant from the hope of myself. There's sadness, and you can imagine what else is there in that line. I am so distant from the hope of myself in which I have goodness and discernment, and never hurry through the world, but walk slowly and bow often. Around me the trees stir in their leaves and call out, "Stay a while." The light flows from their branches, and they call again. "It's simple," they say, "and you too have come into the world to do this, to go easy, to be filled with light and to shine." And so we practice with these heart practices, what we sometimes call the factors of awakening. We develop them, and they help us with balance. And they also, as I mentioned earlier today, they can really be helpful in the moment. When the heart practices become strong, they serve as antidotes when we're in a difficult place, when we have what we might call technically a judgment attack. 3 a.m. or after something difficult happens, we notice the judgmental mind going. If the heart practices are well developed and where our mindfulness is strong, we notice that tendency. We can go to the heart practices and we can actually cut it off when it's too strong, when it's very strong and we're vulnerable. And we can use it in that way. Very, very wonderful. And then lastly, we find that as we stay more and more in these awakened qualities, something in our identity shifts towards awakening as we're more and more there. And Heather and I have had this conversation as to how do we transform judgments more through directly working with them or just indirectly shifting the center of gravity. And both are crucial. Right? Both are really crucial. Sometimes we shift that center of gravity and some of the stuff just falls away. You don't have to defeat it. You don't have to work through it. So it's a very important role for just being with these different states without even thinking about judgments. They actually indirectly transform our sense of ourselves, and some of the judgments just fall away. They don't make sense in a deep way. It's quite interesting. It was very interesting when you had that discussion. It was very, very interesting. Yeah, so we have these two main ways of transformation, and we'll be working with all of them every day. We'll be introducing more of the heart practices. We have these two sessions of heart practice a day. You can bring them in more into your other sittings if you wish. Do 10 minutes of metta at the beginning of every sitting. Wonderful way to do it if you want to strengthen it. Our hope is that by the end of the retreat, everyone who hasn't had a good foundation in loving kindness has one, because we'll be doing it enough. And so you can really use the retreat to continue the momentum after the retreat. So we have the heart practices, and then we have these practices of being mindful of judgments, and we'll introduce other practices in which we start to go beneath the surface. The practice of going into the body that I mentioned, and also practices that start to go beneath the surface of the judgments to work with them and to transform them more and more. And with that process, then, we become more able to notice judgments more quickly. A lot of the difficulty of judgments comes when they sneak up on us, they ambush us, and take us away for like 3 hours, or 3 days, or 3 months, or longer, right? And so much of the practice, this is where the mindfulness is so crucial, so much of the practice is noticing them as soon as possible, and then applying the tools. And it can really work in a beautiful way when we do that. And as we do that more and more, we can notice the judgments sooner. There's less damage. We can even make a vow not to act when we know we're in the throes of the judgmental mind. Very, not to speak or to be careful. Very important. And as we do that more and more, we shift the center of gravity and we start to be able to transform the judgmental mind so we can use that intelligence that's there in the judgments, but not so much as a reason to hurt ourselves, but as we can use that intelligence to respond skillfully and compassionately. So let me just finish with two poems. The first is by Antonio Machado, and this is really pointing to the gifts of our judgments, that if we work with them, actually, we come out of this with the gifts of the intelligence of the judgments, and also quite a bit of compassion for ourselves and for others as we work through them. Last night as I was sleeping, I dreamt, marvelous error, that I had a beehive here inside my heart, and the golden bees were making white honeycombs and sweet honey from my old failures. Making honey out of my old failures. And then the last one is from about 1,000 years ago. This is from Hafiz, if people know Hafiz? He's kind of Rumi's sidekick. less well-known sidekick, right? Okay. How many people know Hafiz? Okay, yeah, very good. Yeah. And do you know that Rumi is the most popular poet in the U.S.? An Islamic poet? Some people don't fully grasp that. Okay, so this is Hafiz, okay? This is called To Build a Swing. You carry all the ingredients to turn your life into a nightmare. Don't mix them. You have all the genius to build a swing in your backyard for God. That sounds like a hell of a lot more fun. Let's start laughing, drawing blueprints, gathering our talented friends. I will help you with my divine lyre and drum. Hafiz will sing 1,000 words you can take into your hands, like golden saws, silver hammers, polished teakwood, strong silk rope. You carry all the ingredients to turn your existence into joy. Mix them, mix them. So, let's just sit for a few moments.